Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. In this part of Focus 580, we will talk, at least in part, a little bit about where we are now with our cities here in the United States, both big and perhaps also with small. Certainly, one of the things that we do know is over the last half century or so, hundreds of major cities all over the world have experienced significant loss of people and also of businesses. And more than a quarter of these cities that have experienced these losses are here in the United States. The question that we'll talk about here this morning, at least one of them, is whether the post-industrial city has a future and how it is cities can be made more livable places that will be attractive and that people will want to live there. And we have two guests here with us this morning, both joining us by telephone, Dan Patera and Cheryl Morgan. Dan Patera is associate professor at the University of Detroit Mercy School of Architecture, and he is also director of the Detroit Center for Collaborative Design. This is a center where they give students real-world opportunities to do design work and then also provide design services to nonprofit organizations. Cheryl Morgan is professor of architecture and also director of the Center for Architecture and Urban Studies at Auburn University in Birmingham, Alabama. She's also taught at Oklahoma State, at the California College of Arts and Crafts, and also at the Georgia Institute of Technology, and has also practiced as an architect in San Francisco. Both of these guests were here a few weeks back for a conference at the University of Illinois, and we had planned on having them here in the studio with us, and I had to be away, and we didn't do the show, but we're pleased that they could spend some time talking with us on the telephone, because we did indeed want to talk with them. And the questions are welcome, as always. All we do is ask people who are calling in to just be brief, as brief as possible, just so that we can keep moving along and get in as many different callers as possible. But callers are welcome, 333-9455, and toll-free, 800-222-9455. Well, Dan Patera, hello.
Hello, how are you?
I'm fine, thanks. And Cheryl Morgan, hello.
Hi.
Thanks for joining us. We appreciate it. Just to begin, I would like to have first Dan Patera talk a little bit about the Detroit Center for Collaborative Design.
Thank you. And first, it's an honor to be here. I appreciate the invitation. It's exciting to have the opportunity to talk about these issues. Our center provides exclusive architecture and urban design work for nonprofit organizations, or I should say exclusively for nonprofit organizations. We believe that in areas of the cities that you referenced at the beginning, the change in neighborhoods where people whose voice are not represented and typically in our society, and the places that have disinvestment, the work that's really happening is happening with nonprofits, and we work exclusively with them to help make regeneration of the city occur in those, particularly in those neighborhoods, but ultimately throughout the city.
Mm-hmm. And Cheryl, you're at your school. You have something that sounds to me at least a little bit similar in its intent. That's the Small Town Design Initiative.
Yes, we are based in Birmingham, Alabama. It's the largest city in Alabama and a great laboratory for students. It's actually a teaching venue for students in our fifth year of architectural studies. And the city, for them, many of the students grew up in suburban or rural areas, so it's an introduction to an urban environment. And we have a bit of a renaissance happening in our downtown, so it's exciting for the students to see new interest in people looking for places to live that are less oriented to commutes, that have more opportunities for what would be a traditional urban experience. At the same time, we have found that across the state of Alabama, there are small towns and communities that are realizing the assets of their traditional historic, in many cases, small towns and the opportunities that that represents for a reinvestment as well. And the notion that communities of 800, 1,200, 2,400 in our traditional southern context are beginning to realize the need for planning, for the value of planning and design to help them take a proactive role in their future is a very exciting one for us. And the students become engaged with that process and helping communities create a plan for their future.
Mm-hmm. It seems to me that what's interesting here, and it came up in a conversation that I had a couple of weeks ago with another guest who has been involved in doing some very big projects in very big cities. One major change that seems to have come about here, at least since the end of World War II, certainly since the 1960s, is that at one time, community development was pretty much carried out behind closed doors. The people that were involved in the political structure and in the business structure, I'm sure, were in on it, and planners were in on it. And then what happened was a plan was developed, and that was just presented to the community, and that was that. And that things, one of the big changes, perhaps, and that's, I'm sure, a challenge to planners, is that people not only expect, citizens not only expect to be involved, they demand to be involved, and I'm sure that you would say, well, that's a good thing, but that it also makes the whole business a lot more complicated. Is that an experience that you can, I'll start with Dan Pittman, is that an experience that you can relate to?
Most definitely. I would say that just start with the last comment that it's more complicated. It may be more complicated, but it's much more rewarding and much more sustainable. And the neighborhoods that are developed through the citizens who live there. They're the ones that are much more knowledgeable what the needs of the neighborhoods are, how that neighborhood could perhaps develop, and we bring an expertise of making that happen. But they also have insights of how the neighborhoods can change, which we could speculate, but we're speculating through other locations and not their location. And so that it may be more complicated in the short run, but in the long run, it allows for a much more comprehensive approach to the design that incorporates more voices, and then thus becomes more sustainable.
Mm-hmm.
I agree with Dan, and I think the thing that's important, too, is that the plan is really needs to be owned by the people who are in the communities. And if they have a voice in the creation of that plan, then they may not agree with everything in the plan, but they know where and how that came to be. And there can be a different kind of consensus building when it was a public and open process. And many of the long-term development propositions in a community, they don't happen quickly, and that's normal. They happen over the life of a community, and so they may bridge several election cycles. And the continuity are the people who live there. And they need the leadership of strong elected officials. They need strong public-private partnerships. There are lots of partners involved in making things happen. But the community needs to have ownership in those plans. We can bring fresh eyes. One of the things that we think is so important in our work is many times there are incredible assets in a community that are not highly valued because people don't look at them. They've always had them. It's always been there. And it might be the kind of thing that could really turn either the local economy or the local sense of pride around. And so we bring those kinds of fresh perspectives. But the best knowledge of the community resides in the people who live there.
Mm-hmm. You know, something that I want to talk to you, and I touched on it in the beginning, and again, maybe I will start here and get a comment from Dan Patera, and Cheryl, I'm sure that you have some thoughts about this too, and that is the shrinking cities phenomenon.
Mm-hmm.
Not something, I know this is not something that is new, although it does seem to be something that in the past few years has gotten more attention. The fact that there are a lot of cities, and a lot of them in the United States, particularly in the north, in the Northeast, or I guess at least on the East Coast, older cities that have lost significant population. People have moved out. Businesses have moved. I came across a wonderful quote from you about this, saying that even the dead people are leaving, because when people people leave, they actually will for their loved ones who are buried there. People do actually relocate their family. So this this is a very significant, not to make light of that, but that a lot of cities, and I'm sure that Detroit is one of them, have experienced this really significant out-migration. And a big challenge for the people in those cities is, what can we do to make the city more appealing so that we can keep people there and perhaps even persuade people to move to the city?
Well, I think the comment of the dead leaving the city, too, it actually does show something that's relatively significant, and that is the perception of the city, not the reality of what the city holds, but the perception of it. As people move out, they begin to form stereotypes of what the city is like. And the reasons why they're moving loved ones out into the suburbs also is because of the fear of what of going back into the city. But it's a fear that is of perception of what. We did a documentary and interviewed people that went to cemeteries in the city before they moved their loved ones out, and never once did they feel threatened or that they have anything occur to them, but it was still this fear that drove them to move their loved ones out. So there's a perception, and that perception, that I use that as an example, but it's symptomatic of why it's been hard to draw people back into the city. Is that's a humorous way to show it, but the reality is that people coming in, we have to begin to break down those perceptions. Detroit is beginning to have a renaissance in its downtown also, and I believe as people start coming through, they say, oh, the city is not as what I remember it to be. But the other thing that's an issue with cities that are shrinking, that's actually a term that I believe I'd like to change, because that's a term that's being thrown around, is the shrinking cities. Because the issue, obviously, as you stated, is the shrinking population. Mm-hmm. The boundaries of the cities have not changed. And so what happens is we get the abandonment and the vacancy is differential, and that begins to establish the perception as you drive through abandonment. You assume things are happening there that may or may not be. But those exact same places offer opportunities. And if we move through a city and you begin to examine the people who are there working in those places, they are doing things that are quite innovative and quite exciting. And I think the future lies in those folks who are working in those places that have been left behind by others, but now creating opportunities of perhaps rethinking some urban our urban place as including green space for everyone and not just little pockets here and there.
Yeah, I know, Charlotte, certainly that smaller communities in urban areas have experienced the same kind of out-migration. Now, the reasons may be slightly different. I suspect a lot of people who live in those communities think that they're good places to live, but that a problem has been, in a lot of places, opportunities, jobs. People have perhaps been forced to go, they maybe haven't wanted to. Are in smaller towns and smaller cities, are the issues similar to that you would see, for example, in Detroit, or are they different?
Well, I think certainly the perceptual one is true almost everywhere we go. And part of this comment I made earlier about fresh eyes, one of the things that we're trying to do is help communities reevaluate what their economic opportunities are, because you're right in saying that people sometimes feel like even though they would prefer perhaps to raise their families or retire in a small town, they don't necessarily believe that there are opportunities to do that. And many of our smaller towns were economically dependent on the traditional southern industries of textile, some agricultural industries and things like that. What we're finding now is that we need to re-educate the communities to look at the things that they have. We do something we call assets-based planning. We start with what are the good things that you have and how can we begin to reposition the economy, the perceptions, based on those good things. So the same community that may have had a strong historic agricultural base still has the countryside that can now perhaps be seen as opportunities for recreation, for wildlife, hiking, biking, all kinds of other things that are growing industries. And so some of the repositioning is one of the most important things that we do. And I think that we're also seeing opportunities for communities to begin to attract families who are downsizing, families who are looking for places to retire but aren't necessarily looking to the traditional retirement venues of Florida, in our case. So this change of perception, I think, is also very important about what are our opportunities. As Dan was saying, beginning to look not at what we lost, but what have we gained with this shift, and how do we reposition ourselves to capture that as an economic potential for the community. And two of the things that we often find in when we're evaluating what helps communities thrive are believing that you can take control of your destiny, but also this strong evidence of pride and pride in the community. And that gets right to the heart of what Dan's talking about, communicating to people who come to your community that this is a place where we believe in ourselves, we believe that this is a great place. And those perceptions are as important as almost any other component of a community.
I was going to say we have a caller, but if you'd like to follow up on that, Dan, go ahead.
If I could just quickly add to that in terms of celebrating what is there that perhaps is a missed opportunity. A great example, the show in Detroit, which many of your callers may have no idea that this doesn't exist, is you could come to Detroit, the birthplace of the mass production of the automobile, and not be able to see an automobile being made. Ford just opened a small little piece of that, but even large corporations here, you would expect to visit Detroit and be able to go to a factory and watch a car being made. That's an opportunity that people, I think, from around would love to see. It's a missed opportunity of celebrating what is here, what is our heritage. That is quite surprising to me. When I arrived for the first time in Detroit, I just assumed I could go to any of the major car manufacturers and watch a car being made and be a part of this large heritage of this place treasures. And it doesn't exist.
Our guest in this part of Focus 580, Dan Patera and Cheryl Morgan. Dan Patera is Associate Professor at University of Detroit Mercy School of Architecture. He's also Director of the Detroit Collaborative Design Center, which is based there. And it is a center that gives students the opportunity to do design work and also provide design services to nonprofit organizations. Cheryl Morgan is Professor of Architecture and also Director of the Center for Architecture and Urban Studies at Auburn University. We have a caller ready to go, someone here where we are in Urbana, line number one. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
Urban planning and cities are issues that I think a lot about, so I'm going to try to limit myself to three main topics that I was hoping your guests could address. The first was the notion of the shrinking city, and I was wondering if a more appropriate term might be a spreading city, because we have, you know, initially people were in the city and then they moved out to the suburbs, and then we have cities like Phoenix where then we have something called exurbs where they're just so far out they're not even part of the city anymore. Another one is I think it's really important to think about how cities are laid out, and it's important for people to have the ability to walk or cycle places, and it's not just a question of distance. There also is this notion of walkability, that you're not just walking through empty parking lots. You know, you need to have items of beauty like monuments and things to need to be more on a human scale. And then I was also hoping that your guests could talk a little bit about why it's desirable to have people living in the cities, for example, a reduced environmental impact. And I will hang up and listen offline.
All right. Well, thanks for those questions. So that could keep us going for quite a while. Mm-hmm. I don't know which of you would like to start, but I'll go to Cheryl. How about if you could comment on any or all of that that you would like?
Thank you. I appreciate all those perspectives, and it gives us a chance to talk about some of the things I think that are systemic and critical to what we're spending our time and energy doing in our work. With our Small Town Design Initiative, one of the things that we're trying to do is celebrate the value of community and small towns. And one of the true core basic concepts of that is the idea of a focused heart of the community, human scale, walkability, and the notion of living in community with neighbors, one of the things that we promote very strongly in our work is connectivity and how even as communities grow, it needs to have a connectivity to the existing structure, the opportunities of reinvestment where you've already created the community, the public investment of infrastructure. That is a huge potential savings for a community. And then discussing with cities the cost of spreading, which not only has environmental cost, as your caller alluded to, but there are cost of services for the city, whether that's police and fire service or creating and providing the infrastructure necessary for that. So we try to help educate our users and our public, our students certainly, who are going to create the next generation of architecture in cities, that there are real environmental benefits, but also real social benefits in creating places where you have a strong sense of identity with the heart of a community, with neighborhood, and as you're walking and moving through cities, that's how you create neighborhood. One of the things that we always do in our work is we put a 5-minute walking radius from wherever we're working, what the people there kind of tell us they feel like is the heart, the place that's the identifiable center of their community or city. And without exception, people are quite shocked to see how close everything is in their city and that they're not walking. And some of the reasons they're not walking are exactly what the caller talked about. They're not good places to walk. There are either no sidewalks or their discontinuity between places where you feel good about walking. And so those are things that we can help communities begin to understand that are very simple additions to the community that can create much more sense of how you come together as citizens in the community.
Hmm. Maybe, Dan, and you can, again, respond to whatever you like that the caller had to say, but I guess I'm particularly interested in the question she raised about perhaps the connections between the idea of decline of a city, particularly in an older inner city kind of situation, and sprawl. And the fact that, yes, it's true if the people have left the central city where they have to go someplace.
Right. That's a very good comment that you made. I think I really appreciate the term spreading cities, up until recently, Detroit was a place where the center was losing population, but it was also considered one of the fastest growing cities on the edges. We have to convince people that to stop building the infrastructure, because people wouldn't be building houses out there if the infrastructure wasn't there. So that has to be there first. We have to convince those folks to stop that, because what's happening is it's not just the inner city that's changing. As you look at satellite maps of the Detroit area, the inner suburbs are now affected. It's just the continual hopscotch that's occurring that has to be changed, because we're the donut effect is what has been termed before. You might have heard where the center is being lost, but that's just becoming more and larger, and that's becoming an issue that's it's almost irreversible in some places. But for us in Detroit, we have a couple natural boundaries that help us, but where we don't, it's the spread is, even with the economic hard times that we have, is continuing to grow quite rapidly.
Mm-hmm. You know, I think that it wouldn't be very difficult to start to make a list of the things that people might value in a community, might want to see, and particularly if there might indeed be things that people say, I have this in my town, I live in a smaller town or a small city, and that they could be, in fact, things like the ability to get where you need to go by walking or perhaps by cycling. Having green space, having open space, having, in some cases, maybe not just green space, but quiet space, some place that seems to be a little bit sheltered from the noise and the hustle and bustles of life, if you're talking about a big city. And it seems to me that one of the great challenges of working in a large city like Detroit, for example, would be how do you manage to retrofit, in a sense, to try to get some of those qualities that are perhaps a little easier to think about if you're dealing with a smaller scale? How do you actually do that in a large, old industrial city?
Yes, and actually, to give you a sense of the scale of how large Detroit is in relationship to the questions that you just raised, and as it relates to the questions that your caller raised, that I'm going to give an example of, the city limits of Detroit, not the suburbs, the city limits of Detroit, you could fit Manhattan, Boston, and San Francisco within their city limits, within our city limits. The vacancy and open space that has been created through vacancy that exists is almost, we're calculating more precise numbers as we speak, almost the scale of the city of San Francisco. So we are essentially rebuilding the city of San Francisco within Detroit. Now, it's spread out throughout the whole city. That's the other thing that makes it a scale issue. It's 138 square miles. So to begin to have these discussions there, they have to be brought down to the individual level, the neighborhood level, because these mass plans that are done and are continually done in places like this begin to become just that, just plans that that do not bring it to the individual. How do they walk to work? How do they bike here and there? Can they do this without the car? Where does mass transportation fit in? An example that I like to bring up for your caller to look at that she's probably aware of, but if not, wonderful to look at, is Bremen in Germany. I bring that example up, and actually the person that's doing most of that, really been spearheading the work, I'm sure I'm going to pronounce the name improper, but it's Michael Glatz-Richter. What they're doing there, they're a northern city that has snow and issues in northern environments, because when we bring things like that in cities like Detroit area, they say, oh, that's fine in southern climates where it's mild, but you can still have all the things that your caller is asking for, these multiple modes of mobility in northern places also, and a wonderful example where that's happening is in Bremen.
I don't know, if Cheryl, if there's anything you'd want to add on to that?
Well, I think that the notion that there are opportunities to create new amenities within the context of our older cities and neighborhoods is something that we're finding as well. Many of these neighborhoods and communities were built, we didn't have the same awareness of some of the environmental issues, or for social justice reasons, or lack thereof, we ended up with families in floodplains, in areas that were really inappropriate for building. And as we began to rectify those things, to buy out the houses from floodplains, we're converting, or we're seeing opportunities to convert those to greenways, to parks, sometimes with passive and sometimes with active recreation. And what we're hoping is that those additional amenities, often in neighborhoods that never had parks or a sense of recreational opportunity, new additions not only rectify some inappropriate building historically, but also create some new market forces to help create reinvestment in those communities, particularly as we're seeing people who would prefer to move back in closer to town, but they're interested in single-family detached houses, a more traditional neighborhood, not an urban downtown experience. We have some of those close-in neighborhoods in many of our older cities, and they need these evidence of public reinvestment, parks, recreation, amenities, to help encourage private investment and for even individual families who want to come into and recapture the opportunities of existing historic houses and existing infrastructure. There needs to be that evidence that their investment is going to be a good and a sound one for the long term.
Mm-hmm. You know, I think about if you take a look at some of the designs, some of the ideas expressed by some notable architects when it comes to cities and the cityscape. And you go back and you look at some of the things that were done certainly before 1950 and back into the 1900s, and you see these massive kind of developments in enormous buildings with just a staggering number of people living in them. It may be that these kinds of things were just design exercises and nobody ever thought those buildings would be built. But when I look at them, the first thing I start to think of the kind of pressure on the infrastructure that they would create, the sustainability issues that they'd raise, and I start thinking about things like, how are you going to deal with all the waste that those people produce? How are you going to deal with their need for energy? How are you going to get everybody where they've got to go? And while those may be a sort of extreme examples, I think that some people might look at the very concept of the city and the concentrations of people that we're talking about and raise the question of sustainability, and perhaps ask this question: is the idea of the large city, as it has existed, you know, say take a place like Detroit, as big as it is the idea of the big city actually viable? Is that something that's worth trying to save and revitalize, or should we be actually thinking about something else?
Well, a very curious and interesting question. I would. Support where you were going towards the end there, that having visited some metropolises throughout the world that make our cities look tiny, like Sao Paulo in Brazil, which the density of folks that are there is quite unique and quite intense. I do think, as exciting and vibrant as that is, talking with people who are there and living in the favela situation that's there, they ask what there's got to be an alternative. I can't say how would you house that many people, because that it's just only going to get worse as we move ahead into the future with people are moving more and more to cities. So I think that's a question we do have to address, but to at least talk about some concepts on how to address them, maybe not what we would do literally, is for Detroit. Many of us are not trying to bring Detroit back to its original population. I don't think that we should be thinking of just returning it back. I think what we should be thinking of is, how do we celebrate a city that maybe looks at urbanism a little differently? And that one of the things that ties this back to one of the previous question that you were asking about, what makes a model community, and you've listed off some wonderful things of green spaces and walkability and so on. One of these ideas, though they're resurfacing again, are actually quite old in our, at least within our country, but even older outside of our location. But the person who made it well known here is Thomas Jefferson. He talked about the middle landscape, where it wasn't rural and it wasn't urban. It was something in the middle, and he wasn't talking suburban. He would be quite disappointed if he saw our suburban environments. What he was trying to bring is a density without the hyper density. That the green space was extremely available at all levels, and at a place where everyone has access to. It was a different understanding of density that I think that places like Detroit, that have large areas now that have been have gone back to nature, as it were, can begin to maybe look at other types of development, as opposed to just reinterpreting a New York or L.A. or something like that within our city limits. Mm.
Well, in a city like that, you may well indeed have to have a kind of a central city with central city infrastructure, but I suppose it's possible, maybe it's, and in fact, maybe that this once more was the case than it is now, that you could, it is possible to look at a city as a collection of conjoined neighborhoods.
Right.
And that then you build that kind, you try to build in the qualities that you're looking for. Maybe you can't do that citywide, but you can do it. You can look at small areas and develop within a certain kind of boundary, try to build those characteristics into that place and that area, and then move on and try to do that in the next.
Mm-hmm. And then perhaps the spaces in between those neighborhoods begin to become, since it's throughout the city, in a place like Detroit, that they become this sort of linear park, or a lengthy park, where it isn't just these sort of little the central park that happens in one location. It's long, but in one location, it can now be something that's much more of a, if you will, a spider web throughout the city, and it begins to ring the neighborhoods.
Mm. And I think that if you look particularly at our larger cities, they really are a collection of villages already. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you, I lived in San Francisco, and, you know, of course we'd all say I live in San Francisco, but I lived in the Lower Haight. I lived in the, you know, different neighborhoods that people will tell you about. They live in the Mission. They live in North Beach. The same is true of New York City, of Chicago. You look at Paris. You look at Rome. People will tell you the neighborhood that they live in, because that's the scale we identify with in terms of the shops, the churches, the neighborhood people that we call our neighbors and that we see on a day-to-day basis. And I think as if we take that conceptual idea and then some of the things that Dan's talking about with the notion of the things that we need for our sense of well-being and our connections with nature and that balance between our compact development that gives us a real sense of community and the accessibility to natural environment with parks and greenways and connectivity, then we really can begin to look at a way to provide good living environments that have a density but with and don't chew up the green fields of our natural landscape. Provide some real alternatives when people are trying to look at ways not to have to get in a car for every single thing that they need. That those models are pressing in not only our conscientious look at long-term sustainability, but I think more and more people are looking to the way their lifestyle has devolved and their dependence on cars and their the chaotic nature of how they can manage to do the things they need to do, and are looking for an alternative way to live that gives them those true choices.
We have about 10 minutes left, maybe a little bit more, in this part of Focus 580. I have a caller we will get to in just a moment. I also want to introduce again the guests. The last person you heard, Cheryl Morgan, is professor of architecture and also director of the Center for Architecture and Urban Studies at Auburn University. Also joining us is Dan Patera. He is associate professor at the University of Detroit Mercy School of Architecture and also director of the Detroit Collaborative Design Center, which is based there at his school, where they and their students provide design services for nonprofit organizations. Both of them were here in Champaign-Urbana some weeks back for a big conference on urban planning, and we were going to have them on the show. And I had to be away, but we still wanted to see if we could have this conversation, talk a little bit about urban planning issues, and they were good enough to say, yeah, they would give us some time. So we're pleased that they're both talking with us. And questions here from people who are listening are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455, and we do have two callers here ready to go. First on our toll-free line, someone calling from Paxton. This is line 4. Hello?
Yes, I'd be fascinated by your comments about the growth of Tucson, if you're at all familiar with the growth in Tucson, and I'll hang up and just listen to your comment.
Okay.
Thank you.
Well, can one or both of you talk about Tucson?
Dan, why don't you jump in on that one?
I haven't visited Tucson. My wife actually went to school in Tucson and was just visited. She also has a architecture and planning background, and has just visited it and has relayed back to me what she has seen, which was shocking to her. How much things have changed in that entire area. But I honestly can't give much intellectual background to that, so I apologize for that.
Is it possible to say anything general about the Southwest in general? Because certainly that has been a part of the country where they have been experiencing really significant growth.
I think one of the things that sort of all of us on the outside looking in with limited knowledge about all the pressures going on there we're always concerned about development that has that intensity in an area where there's such limited resources of water in particular, and concerns about the long-term sustainability with traditional development in that kind of area. Of course, that's something that we all need to be very conscientious about, but in particular where it's a very scarce resource.
All right. Well, then we will go on to a couple of other local callers here. Next is in Champaign, and this would be line number one. Hello.
Yeah, hi. Mm-hmm. Actually, what happens, and this isn't the reason I'm calling, but Vegas is another example of it in terms of water. I just wonder where they're, you know, the expansions there is still pretty intense and all that. But actually, my main one is, and especially from Illinois, I don't know when states are going to start doing something, but I believe that in Michigan that there is sort of some kind of protection for farmland or something or other. Is that correct?
Yes, but it's the loopholes are quite large. We lose about we've lost 900,000 acres, if I got that number right, in a 10 to 20 year period. I mean, sorry, in a 20 year period. There is definitely protection, but there's quite a few ways around that.
Yeah, and do you want to comment that when are states going to finally get smart and do something or other? Because I see this happening in I'm originally from the Chicago area, and the southwest part is really expanding like crazy. And, you know, they're putting in huge shopping centers that are going to compete with, it's just overwhelming. So anyway, if you'd like to comment on any of that, it'd be great.
In terms of the Michigan area, which though is typical across the U.S., as we all know, the way that cities are growing, and his comment on Vegas is an excellent comment on how what is happening there with water and how it's also the watershed of Vegas and collapsing with the watershed of L.A. and so on. Is really quite it's tremendous what is not necessarily in a good way of what is happening there. I'm hoping that the efforts that we do, both Cheryl and myself, are, you could argue, very grassroots oriented. That we truly believe that any social ecological change in our society comes from the desire of the people. We really believe in that sort of method, and that with enough folks understanding really what the issues are, that they'll begin to have the legislature to make a change. I know this is optimistic, but I don't think that we're going to have that many insightful people on the top that will say, okay, let's make this change, unless the people below yes, this is what we want, so they will reelect that person. I think that's always the fear that we have with our four-year or so systems. So I do believe that it has to come from the awareness of everyone that is within these within the cities and the suburbs to understand the variety of conditions. I would just add a couple quick things. There's a researcher called Robert Putnam who talks about social capital, which isn't exactly a word that he's developed, but a word that he's given quite a bit of wonderful research and insight to. And quickly, he talks about how really lifespan and the quality of healthy lifestyle comes with interaction from people. I think we know that, but he's begun to give it a sort of a document, quantifiable condition. And he has shown that the further and further you move out from cities, the lower your lifespan is, and how more health problems occur with people who move further and further out. So it may need to be other things like that to help convince people that really it's not just we as humans are part of the environment, and we are hurting ourselves as well as the environment as we move further and further out.
I would expect, Cheryl, where you live, that there would certainly be big concern about development of farmland there.
There is, and part of that is the shifting economy. So what we're trying to do is to, as I said earlier, reposition the sense of economic opportunity with land that was traditionally farming. One direction is we're supporting a lot of efforts to help promote organic farming and some other farming types that are actually letting economically letting some small family farms sustain themselves or have a sense that they can move on to the next generation. So some of the pressure for selling farms has been families feeling like they can't make a living as farmers anymore. So we're trying to help with different numbers of groups who are working to actually create opportunities for farms to be maintained, particularly at the small family farm scale. And then the notion that even areas where farming is not going to be part of the economy, protecting and preserving the open space has so inherently to do with our sense of local character, our sense of self in the South, that we need to preserve that as not only an environmental issue, but as a potential economic opportunity for outdoor recreation, for everything from hunting and fishing to canoeists and bird watchers. And if we don't preserve and protect that character, it dramatically limits the potential to do appropriate economic development around those possibilities. So we're kind of coming at it from the other direction, saying if we can create strong, viable economic reasons for preserving the open space, that shifts the equation in terms of the pressure for development, particularly to the individual landowner.
Well, I want to try to get at least one more caller. This would be the next in line would be someone listening in Champaign and on line two. Hello.
Hello, good morning.
Mm-hmm.
I would be interested in hearing the guest perspective on what has to happen with schools in the inner city and the quality of education, because that seems to be a driving force in a lot of families fleeing, and what we can do to help facilitate the change. And I'll hang up and answer and listen. Thank you very much.
Okay. Well, again, I guess I'll turn to Dan first. Is that something that you've thought about?
We have. I don't have detail, but it's one of the, if you're going to list like a top 10 things that need to happen in the cities, which I've done for myself. I don't have the list in front of me, but one or two is schools. I think that if you look at the city of Detroit, the people that are moving in, actually the city of Detroit has had the largest housing starts than any other suburban town. So actually that's a positive thing when you see that actually maybe it's slightly turning, but those housing starts and the people moving in are people, young professionals, young folks to empty nesters, and the group in between are still fleeing, and that's because essentially the public school system doesn't offer an opportunity. I think something has to be done. I think the issue with cities like Detroit is scale, and I don't know what I mean by that, but I think somehow it has to be broken down a bit. When we look at a suburban school system that has 5,000, 10,000 students, and we see the quality of that, and we look at Detroit school system, which has somewhere around 170,000 students, the question is very very obvious that we have to begin to figure out how to work with a scale of that. Is it broken down into smaller subsections that help the how do you manage that many schools and that many students? I think the problem is it's lost at the individual level. The student, the parent is lost in the process, and then the quality is obviously affected. There's obvious financial problems in all, not just our cities, but cities that are considered doing well have problems with their public school systems. It's something that has to occur on many levels to correct, but the large systems like ourselves, I think, need to find ways to break themselves down and scale in some way.
Hmm. I suppose on the other end, certainly in rural areas, communities have a difficult time maintaining their schools because they have shrinking numbers of students. And there you have to end up looking at consolidation and things that people don't like, because they think that obviously having a school near them is an important feature. And yet it seems in a lot of communities that's less and less possible. I don't know, Cheryl, is that something that you've thought about?
Well, I think the point is very well taken. Schools are one of the most significant issues in families making choices about where to live. Interestingly, statistically, and it depends a little bit on whose statistics you look at, but between 75 and 85% of the households in our country right now do not have a school-aged child, which is a kind of shocking number. And so when you look at that and then you think about how many people should really be available to make choices about where they live that's not tied specifically to the school system, you would think there'd be more energy and movement. Some of it's what Dan's saying, that you do have empty nesters, young professionals, who are part of the revitalization of our cities where, and even our small towns where schools are not going to be the thing that is attracting them. But I think we all value an educated community. And so it's even when we look at that statistic that says more and more of us are not going to have to make a choice based on the schools, it is such a fundamental issue with the quality of life and the people that we're living with in community that it has to be one of the things that we address. And I agree with Dan, I think the scale is very important because in the smaller towns where we work, particularly those that have their own local school system, they have a stronger educational system, even with the limited resources, than larger county systems or systems that are in the smaller cities but are still huge by comparison to those small towns. So I think the numbers is a really significant thing that we have to be very careful that we don't be penny-wise and pound-foolish about how educational resources are spent and that we don't get economy of scale about facilities and administrative costs at the expense of the quality of the education for the student.
We will have to stop there because we've come to the end of the time, having discussed a lot of different things. We want to say thanks to our two guests, Sean Morgan and Dan Patera. Sean Morgan is professor of architecture and director of the Center for Architecture and Urban Studies at Auburn University. Sean Morgan, thank you very much.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
And Dan Patera, associate professor, University of Detroit Mercy School of Architecture, and also director of the Detroit Collaborative Design Center there. And Dan, thank you very much.
Thank you. It was delightful to be a part of this. Thanks for including me in this discussion.